This episode, I'm joined by James Maffey to discuss his book, Aztec Philosophy, Understanding a World in Motion. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast going into 2024, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Jim Maffey, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Going to discuss your book, Aztec Philosophy, Understanding a World in Motion, which is published by the University of Colorado in 2015.
But 2014.
So has there been a couple of editions, or have I just got that wrong?
No, I mean, there's a hardback and a paper, but they're essentially unchanged.
Okay. So as people would imagine, this is a book about Aztec philosophy. And I don't really need to say more about that until we get into it. But one thing I will say about it is it's just over 600 pages long. So if you, if at the end of this conversation, you want to learn everything there is to know, dare I say, about Aztec philosophy, then go head over and grab a copy of the book. This is, it's extremely accessible book, extremely well written. It was a real delight to read. And so what I want to start with, Jim, is a bit about yourself, what it is you do. And I guess the history of the book, but also, you know, when did you first come across Aztec philosophy, and when did you think, okay, this is going to be maybe a life's work?
Well, I'm an academically trained philosopher, and I got trained in Anglo-American analytic philosophy, so this was a bit of a stretch. But I always had a long-standing interest in anthropology. Ever since I was a kid, I wanted actually to be an archaeologist as a kid. My parents said, "No, you can't do that. You'll never make a living."
So you became a philosopher instead.
Exactly. So after I finished my degree, my degree was in analytic Anglo-American analytic epistemology, really mainstream stuff. Although it was in this branch that was emerging at the time called naturalized epistemology, in which philosophers were arguing that epistemologists should start paying attention to the real world and stop trying to solve the Cartesian problem of how do I know the world exists from a position of nowhere. And most of the people who did that went into pursued linguistics and cognitive psychology, which is much in keeping with sort of Anglo-American philosophy, dating back to, you know, Locke, Hume, Berkeley. They're all focused upon the individual and the individual mind and the contents of the mind. Having spent a lot of time reading anarchists like Kropotkin and Marxists like Marx and Engels, you know, I thought that we should be paying attention to the social and the anthropological as well. Some folks pursued the sociological and they were quickly vilified. I pursued the anthropological because we had epistemologists claiming that all people everywhere pursue truth, right? And that's so therefore knowledge has to be defined in truth. And their evidence for that was Aristotle. And I'm thinking to myself, I mean, Aristotle isn't everybody. It's one guy. So I thought I'd start hunting around and looking, you know, starting reading anthropological literature and seeing whether or not that was the case. In the course of doing that, in about 1995, I came across a book by Miguel Leon Portilla, translated and abridged as Aztec Thought and Culture. Mm-hmm. The original was his thesis, I believe, published in 54, 56 in Mexico City, called La Filosofía Nahuatl, the Nahuatl philosophy. Nahuatl being the language of the Aztecs, and commonly all Nahuatl people in this area of the high central plateau of Mexico are Nahuatl speakers, and they are commonly referred to as Nahuas. So Leon Portilla's book sort of represents what's going on, because it was not published as a philosophy book. It was published as an anthropology book. Philosophy was removed from the title, the original being La Filosofía Nahuatl, and replaced with Aztec Thought and Culture. So the translation, the redubbing of the book really much tells the story that Western philosophers don't think anybody outside of the West does philosophy. This wasn't philosophy proper. This was thought and culture. that made it very, very safe and therefore easy to ignore for academic philosophers. So I read that and I said, wow, this is really great. This is good stuff. And I read his book. I started reading more of his work and I, you know, fell in love with it. I went down to Mexico to a school to learn Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs, in 2000, 2001, and just pretty much never looked back, never saw any reason to go back to Anglo-American epistemology, which I find numbingly sterile. So this is what I now do, and I have become what, you know, people call a Nahuatlist. And my community is other people who work in this area. So even though, and I publish with University Press of Colorado because it publishes in this area. It's the leading publisher in this area, rather than going with someone like Oxford or Cambridge, because there it would be published as a philosophy text at best, but marginalized. It would just disappear, be invisible. And frankly, other academic philosophers don't know anything about this, so they're not really who I wrote it for, because they don't really know if what I'm saying is good or bad, right or wrong. So I wrote it for other Nahuatlists, other Mesoamericanists. So that's sort of the origins of that. And like I said, I just never looked back. So this is what I've been doing since almost 30 years now.
You think we still have that sort of in the West, you know, it's very broad in the same way that, you know, you might speak about the East, it's very broad. And someone like Jay Garfield would disagree with that, of course. But in the West, we still have that thing of like, we're the only people who do philosophy, and anything outside, like you said, it's culture or it's thought or it's, I don't know, maybe even theory.
Wisdom, literature. Wisdom.
I mean, that, you know, I was thinking that when you said it. I mean, if you go back to the etymology of philosophy, the study of wisdom, there is something in Aztec philosophy, which is much more of an intuitive study of wisdom, as opposed to, like, you know, as you said, sterile, analytic, right? Okay, let's get into the conditions and the causes and etc. So there is, it's almost closer to the etymology, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's still there. It's widening. Philosophy is, I mean, if you look at the late 20th century philosophers, some started to begrudgingly acknowledge philosophy in South Asia, India, and East Asia, China, Japan. And so a guy named Benjamin Sharfstein referred to Europe, India, China, Japan as the big three. And so then people go, okay, them. But then the rest of the world was still mythology, proto something or other. But that's starting to change now. I'm very happy to say in the last 10 years, 15 years, you're finding more positions offered in indigenous philosophy, North American philosophy. African philosophy has finally, come into its due. East Asian, South Asian are going ahead very strongly. Mesoamerica, Mexico, Central America, and South America still, I think, lag behind in this area. There just aren't the people doing it. But I think I know some younger scholars who are pursuing some of this. So things are changing, but snail's pace.
Yeah.
And frankly, people still will come up to me and go, this really isn't philosophy, is it? You're just, it's a scam, right? They think I'm doing something. And I don't know what they think I'm trying to pull off or get away with, because doing this pretty much amounts to career suicide. Nobody thinks it's real philosophy. So it's not like I'm getting some plum of a job because I've done this. So,
600 page scam, 600 page well-researched scholarly scam.
Quickly point out that for your listeners that the book is Aztec philosophy, but it really is the focus on Aztec metaphysics. That is sort of the theory of the nature, structure, and constituents of the world. If they're looking for, philosophy broadly will concern actually, things like ethics and morality and the theory of knowledge, epistemology, and it has very little of that. I'm currently working on those projects. So just so your listeners know what not to expect. I would have entitled it Aztec Metaphysics, but the publisher said no. It's got to be philosophy.
Okay.
So hopefully the subtitle after the colon, Understanding the World in Motion, sort of gives people the idea that it is, you know, their theory of reality, their metaphysics.
Mm. Okay. Okay. Disclaimer. But beginning with that world in motion, really, the metaphysics, and I'm probably going to mispronounce so many things throughout this talk, but it begins, and I'm hesitant to say, to use the word central, because that probably wouldn't actually work here, but abstractly central to all of this is Teotl. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Teotl. The L at the end is silent.
So, Teotl?
Teotl.
Okay. So that Teotl is central. And so I will just ask the broad question. What is Teotl?
As I understand it, it's this sort of all-encompassing, universal sort of power, force, energy. Energy is kind of a modern term, but everything, it is everything, and everything is made out of it. So there's ultimately sort of one thing in the world, one ultimate constituent. If you were to take an inventory of what exists in the world, ultimately it's all just this one stuff, this power, this energy in motion, this force that just keeps chugging along. It's eternally generating, self-regenerating, and it emerges out of itself, it unfolds out of itself. It's constantly transforming. Transformation is very essential to understanding this and to understanding Aztec and Mesoamerican metaphysics generally. This notion that the world is always in the state of transformation, it's always in a chance of becoming something else. And it's also always moving. It's always processing. Some contemporary native peoples in the Mixtec speakers in Oaxaca and Zapotec speakers nearby liken it to this sort of force to electricity. And actually Huichol speakers in northern Mexico liken it to that as well. There's this notion that this everything exists because it is empowered. If it didn't have power, it would not exist. And what is power is the ability to make things happen, to do things, to act. So we have this notion that action precedes essence instead of vice versa. Namely, things are what they do. They don't do what they are. So things are what they do, and everything that exists does something. It acts, it moves, it changes, it has an effect upon other things. That's what it is to exist.
I noticed already that you mentioned that, like, we use the word energy, but already this is why I mentioned earlier this sort of, when I was as I was reading your book, you know, and you mentioned that you actually went and learned the language, it seems like there is this barrier of there's always going to be an element of the understanding, because in the West we love language, we love logic, we love putting everything in its place and defining it, and that works for us. But there's an intuitive, perhaps more holistic sense. I mean, I'm struggling with the language here. So this notion of energy, I mean, I want to add in, well, question two things there, I guess, to constantly have it in this silly dialogue with the West so we can understand it, us Westerners. There's two things I think is, you know, one is this a deity, but also, because that's how we often think about things when we speak about big beings or whatever. And the other sense is, you know, that sense of regeneration of a universal substance, it reminds me of something like Lucretius. Know, of an atomism self-regenerating. So I guess, you know, is it close to either one of those? Because that's how we often think about things, I think, is the split in the West is this materialist atomist sense, or, you know, all the substance is connected to a singular deity.
Well, kind of, I would distance it from Lucretius. I put it closer to the deity, but this is atheistic. Right. So Teotl isn't a deity. Deity is no. It's sort of a pantheism, actually. So pantheism is this notion that pantheism, despite its name suggesting that everything is God, really is atheistic. There is no such thing as God for pantheists. So it's this notion that everything is constituted by this power. This power that makes things happen, this power that is self-regenerating, self-engendering. What you and I understand as persons, humans, but also non-humans, plants, tables, trees, cooking pots, instruments, as well as more powerful than human persons, what typically get called deities, like Tlaloc, who's the person associated with rain and snow and hail and flooding and thunder. These are simply sort of momentary coagulations or poolings of this power. So it's not polytheistic. Mm. It's not theistic. It is, strictly speaking, atheistic. But why is it sacred, Teot? Because it is powerful. And by native lights, that which is powerful is sacred. So from that, it also follows that everything's sacred. Mm. Some things may be more sacred than others, in virtue of the fact that they're more powerful, but there's no sacred profane dualism or dichotomy in this worldview, in this philosophy, in the way that there is, say, in Abrahamic religions. Mm. Everything is sacred. And a nice dramatic example of that is there's a more powerful than human one, we can call them non-human, or an anthropologist named Irving Howell calls them other than human persons, named Tlatzolteot. She is associated with, her name literally means sacred filth, sacred disorder, sacred excrement. Mm-hmm. And what she does is consume filth, disorder, malarrangement, excrement, mm-hmm. and she transforms it into humus, into fertility. In fact, one of the codices depicts her giving birth to Maize Boy, Senteot, right? So from filth, from excrement, from disorder comes maize, mm-hmm. right? So she transforms, she's sacred, right? She has this power to transform disorder into order from that which is filth, disordered excrement, right? Into something well ordered. So even disorder is sacred.
Yeah. So this going back to this notion of action precedes essence in relation to power. I mean, that's fascinating. So when you think of something such as a storm, this massive burgeoning, raging thunder and storm, the sacredness arises from the fact that that is a part of Teot, which is absolutely clearly doing. It is
emphatic and very
action.
Powerful.
Yeah, and very powerful.
Overwhelming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there's this impulse, beginning with Plato to look for the essence of things and then explain their function in terms of what their essence is. On this view, you go and you look what they do, and from what they do, you can learn what they are. But really, the emphasis is always upon how things act, what they do. Mm-hmm.
So any hard stops, any points we say, like, for instance, I go outside and I can look at a tree and I can go up and I can touch it and say, like, this is here, this is matter, and it's here, and it's going to stay here for a bit. That the idea of that being a hard stop of something solid is only really from my context for a short amount of time. But really, if I was to look at it from the point of view of Aztec philosophy, that is fluxing. That's in this flux of regeneration, self-regeneration.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of resonances here with Taoism, right? Mm-hmm. And the Chinese notion of qi, right, resonates a lot with Teot. And also that notion of flux you also get in Taoism, right? That you look out at the tree and you only see it one moment in this stage of its becoming, mm-hmm. of its processing, of its transforming from seed to mature to death. So it's a mistake to sort of, reify things and sort of hypostasize them in these static moments and say, no, that's what it really is. Mm.
So this power, I mean, once again, I'm sort of stuck with Western projections and appreciations of power. And I mean, most famously, you'd have someone such as Nietzsche, with the will to power, the dialectic between really a moralism there of the strong over the weak. Probably an authoritarianism, a totalitarianism. The power of the Aztec philosophy seems not to really be like that at all. It's almost like, for instance, a storm doesn't have an agenda. That's what I'd say. So what's the key difference between typical Western power and Aztec power?
I think you may have hit it, right? Teo doesn't have an agenda. Teo's not going anywhere in the sense of telos and it's into a purpose, or and it hasn't really been anywhere. It's just this constant going. Constant
no becoming. First cause?
No. It's no. There's no ex nihilo creation, no ex nihilo destructions. All creation emerges out of destruction, and all destruction transforms into new creation. So no, there's no hard stops cosmogonically.
So it always was.
So why? It's just there. At this point, I think they just say, don't know. It's just the way things are. It's always been. That's just how it behaved. So yeah, it's just there, and it just keeps chugging along, and it does so in a very sort of cyclical manner. If you can, you know, visualize, as I'm sure you can, the yin-yang teardrop from Taoism, if you were to put that into motion, it would just keep going like this, right? Yin-yang, 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 yin-yang. And that, it would always been that way, and it's always going to just do that, where it's never really been anywhere. It's not really going anywhere. It's just continuing, continuous processing. So there's no purpose to Teot. There's no telos. Telos isn't a person, isn't an agent, doesn't have an agenda. It's just there. The world, I mean, it's just there. And why? This is where we just don't know.
It's so, I mean, it's very telling, but Western philosophy especially really struggles. I mean, you know, a large part of theology, for instance, Western theology, is justification. Something like Anselm's argument, right? We really struggle with, yeah, okay, that's the limit. We don't get to know that. Well, I mean, so, and I should say a big part of your book is, you know, you expand upon your understanding of Aztec philosophy, and then you engage in a sort of dialogue with previous scholarship and, dare I say it, like at certain points in time, misunderstandings or misappreciations of Aztec philosophy. Why do you think it is we struggle with that notion of just is, and we're never going to get to know? Why do you think we struggle so much with that?
Who's the we? We Westerners?
We Westerners, we hard-headed, logical Aristotelians.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a tough one. I mean, there could be a variety of reasons for a variety of people, but yeah, I don't really know. But yeah, we do struggle with that. We have a problem with just saying, it just is this way. That's just the way things are, and there's no why or wherefore. I mean, ultimately, right? I mean, everything gets to that anyway, right? Even with Christian God, it's just, why? Well, why was the Big Bang? Well, just, you know, just is. Just.
What would you maybe say to Western philosophers who are always searching for teleologies and hard stops and reason especially, who might say that just, you know, that ongoing yin and yang that never stops, that's kind of it might see it as nihilistic.
I don't. What's nihilistic about it?
Once again, I mean, I'm sort of playing. Western advocate, but you know, there's no meaning to it. There seems to be no purpose. Would you just say so?
I mean, that's all true. There's no purpose or meaning. The cosmos wasn't here for a reason. That's true. I mean, I guess addressing that, we could go to more of the cosmogony, come to the current age, right? Humans currently live in what the Aztecs refer to as the fifth sun earth ordering. There are four sort of suns or creations or worlds before ours. And this one gets created by or generated or engendered by two folks, guys named Tezcatlipoca and Quetzalcoatl. And they sort of create this world in this sort of yin-yang way, one representing yin, the other yang. And it's through their mutual balancing and antagonism and yet complementing that the fifth world comes about. Human beings, these powerful, other than humans, generate the world, they're enervated. They're exhausted. They've spent all their energy creating this, and they require to be nourished.
Mm.
So sort of taking a leaf from the K'iche Maya text, the Popol Vuh, it would seem that the gods or these powerful non-humans bring human beings into existence in order to nourish them.
Mm.
But the way they nourish them principally is through speech, through words. And we nourish them. So it turns out very interesting that we nourish them and they nourish us. We feed them and they feed us. We eat them and they eat us. So they aren't deities or gods in any sort of Abrahamic sense. Mm. We're mutually interdependent. We feed one another. We nourish one another. We eat one another. So we eat them. And if we think they're sacred, that makes us sacred. They eat us. And if we think we're less than, you know, less powerful, then they become that. So there's really this homogeneity between humans and powerful non-humans. There's a fundamental notion. It's just there, a given, called masehwa, is to merit or to deserve or to earn. And through the expenditure of energy, teyot, right? But in this case, there are different, teyot kind of splits up into different kinds of energy. And this one's called chikahualitzli. They merit us into existence through the expenditure of their energy. And then we are born with, you could say, original obligation, indebtedness. We are born obligated to return the gift of life to them because they have given us the gift of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so Aztec ethics and morality emerge out of this fundamental notion of masehwa, that we are born obliged to reciprocate. And so reciprocity, in fact, turns out to be this fundamental sort of engine of the world where we gift them, they gift us. And it's through mutual gifting that one generates proper social relationships, both with humans, but with other than humans, with trees, corn, mountains, rain, sun, everything. So is there a purpose? I guess human beings, even though the cosmos doesn't have a purpose in terms of teyot going somewhere, human beings are born with, I guess, a purpose, which is to maintain balance in the cosmos, in particular this, the fifth creation. We are here to keep things well balanced. And that is and why? I guess that's because we were born, because that's why the gods created us.
Humans are particular to this fifth world,
yeah.
This fifth grade. We weren't in the
right.
Last four.
No, there were sort of proto-humans. There were different sorts of, organisms, giants in one and then others. So no, humans are this. So this gives us a unique position, a unique responsibility. It's our duty, our responsibility to keep this fifth age going, keep it in balance. And we do that through constant reciprocal gifting, entering into gifting relationships with other things. This, however, does not give us any privilege or moral status in terms of being the crown of creation or the only ones. We're not made in the image of the God, any of that stuff. We have the special responsibility, but we don't have any higher moral status, any privilege moral status. So we're not better than maize plants or lizards or snakes or bows and arrows or cooking pots, for example.
Mm.
So, yeah. So I guess that answers the question about nihilism.
Mm, definitely. It answers it very clearly as well. So what as you say you're working more on the moral and ethical side of Aztec philosophy now, I mean, just to tie that in, what would a moral life look like in relation to Teotl? I mean, would we consider this worship, or is it, just more of a reciprocal reverence? Because, as you say, we are that thing as well. So
right. It's definitely not worship in the Abrahamic sense. It's respect.
Mm.
And you demonstrate your respect by reciprocal gifting, by uttering the right sorts of words, but you can also reciprocate through foodstuffs, through poetry, through song, through dance, through burning incense, and also with blood sacrifice, what we call sacrifice, right? Those are all ways of gifting back to the deities, the gods, life energy to keep them going. But they in turn then gift us their life energy. Their water is in a sense earth's blood, and they gift us water all the time. So there's this constant circulation through reciprocal gifting. Mm-hmm. And that's what respect looks like. And that's what worship, with scare quotes around it, looks like. It's, yeah. And yeah, okay.
You mentioned blood sacrifice there. I mean, it seems like it's a very life-centric philosophy, you know, the gift of life, revere life. You know, this is all a reciprocal relation of this rebirth cycle.
Yeah.
How then does Aztec philosophy conceptualize, say, death and suffering, which are all parts of life?
To back up a little bit, I mean, it's life-centered in the sense that everything is animate, also, right? Because since everything's energized and constituted by Teot, and Teot is a vivifying life force. So everything is, in a sense, animate. And I haven't sorted out where the animate personhood distinction lies, but I mean, trees, insects, birds, animals, mountains, rivers, clouds, they're all animate, and they all tend to be persons. Mm-hmm. And so living well in the world is a matter of negotiating all these social relationships. It's knowing how to get along with other persons. It's a social world. It's not just human beings working on dead stuff. We have to work to gain the cooperation of our cars, our computers, our cooking pots, our digging sticks, as well as maize, trees, plants, everything. So it's this large social world, and we're learning how to negotiate all these social relationships to bring about balance in them, but also to further our own agenda of living a well-balanced life. Let me see. So how do we conceive death? Death is not the same. I mean, there's death as disintegration, but there's no such thing as death as in terms of, in a sense, non-being or non-existence. The standard view here, this isn't my view, this guy named Lopez Austin, human beings are sort of constituted by three different life forces. And those upon death sort of disintegrate. One of them appears, and here I'm only saying appears because our sources have been heavily Christianized. Mm-hmm. There are no primary sources in the sense of written by the Aztecs themselves before the conquest. All our sources are colonial. They're all written by Spaniards. So, and Spaniards with an agenda, which was to extirpate native religion and convert to Christianity. So what we have to take with a large grain of salt. But it appears as if one part of one of those, a Yolia, which sort of is the one which here scholars disagreed. I mean, the standard account is that there's an underworld called Mictlan, and that this would go down there. Some other scholars, polar scholars, have recently argued that Mictlan, this sort of so-called land of the dead, is really not under the world. This guy is Christian, but there are just spaces here on the surface of the earth which constitute the underworld, the land of the dead. But the dead are alive, right? Mm-hmm. They're the living dead. Which I think is much like the case with Confucianism, perhaps, right? That the dead keep on living in some sense. They're still there, and you can still access them, although it's very difficult. But they're still around. So
it's not really an afterlife in the common sense we'd understand.
You know, the sources will say that warriors who died in battle or warriors who died on the sacrificial stone, their Yolia, this one life force of theirs out of three, helps the sun rise every morning to noon. Mm-hmm. It's a heroic activity. And after, I think, 4 or 5 years of doing that, they become monarch butterflies. Women who die in childbirth, childbirth is seen as this sort of warlike struggle to mm-hmm. bring somebody into the world. They spend their time helping the sun pretty much die every afternoon from noon to evening. So there's some afterlife. People who die in water-related causes, dropsia, drowning, are said to go to Tlalocan, right? This place of a watery paradise. What's important to note is that, accepting all of this is the case, that where one ends up after death has no relationship to the moral quality of one's life. You can be an evil son of a bitch, but if you drown, you're going to Tlalocan, which looks like a pretty sweet place, and you can be a morally upstanding person and drown and go there too, or die a natural death and go to Mictlan, which it's not described as a very attractive place. So you don't have any incentive in life to be moral because of an afterlife. The incentives are always here and now. Namely, if you act improperly, you disorder yourself. So immoral actions are ones which disorder and imbalance things. They imbalance others, and they imbalance and disorder yourself. And the result of that is dis-ease, mental disease, physical disease, social disease, you know, ruining your family, ruining your neighborhood, ruining your mind, your body. So the motivation is always, in a sense, very prudential, right? Mm-hmm. The sort of prudential moral distinction, I'm not sure, holds up very clearly here. Mm-hmm. I mean, the motivation to be moral in terms of regifting the god's life energy, I mean, it's not really it's not moral as we think of it in terms of being distinct from the prudential. I mean, Western philosophy distinguishes the pragmatic or the prudential from the moral. And I think those are blurred here, right? They would argue that it's a mistake. Well, to say they're blurred assumes there's a distinction and they're ignoring it, right? But that begs the question. They would argue it's a mistake. It's a false distinction. It's a distinction, a difference without a distinction. You shouldn't make that distinction. And Western philosophers are guilty of that error. So here you have the double-edged sword.
So Teyot is immoral. And then the...
Amoral, right.
Amoral. And then the... So the focus for individuals is all about equilibrium. Our balance, equilibrium,
uh-huh.
order. And the signs that something, I mean, I think of someone such as Galen, who said that, you know, when your organs are balanced, they don't make any noise, for instance. So the signs for order and balance is a perceived harmony in the world around you.
Yeah, I would replace it with balance. Mm. Harmony suggests a sort of quietude and peaceableness, mm-hmm. which is also, you know, sort of, yeah, but I would replace it with balance. Mm. That, because for the Aztecs, for the Mexica, balance is a function of a struggle between these what I call anomic partners, these sort of male, female, hot, cold, wet, dry. And these things are interrelated like yin yang in Taoism. And these are always complementing, recycling, alternating. They're mutually arising, but they're also mutually competitive, right? And that agonism, that competitiveness, I think undercuts the notion that this is harmony. Well-orderedness and balance are the function of both cooperation, complementarity and competitiveness of struggle. Life struggles against death. light struggles against darkness, darkness against death. This is constantly going on every day, right? Mm. Night struggles against day, day, night. And it's going like this. And if those are properly ordered in that struggling, then you have balance. Mm. But you'd never have harmony.
No. But it seems almost once that reaches its balance, we wouldn't even almost call it a struggle. It's everything in its right. Everything in its right place.
But you never get there finally, right? No hard stops.
That
no...
would be to anthropomorphize like night and day, right? To say like they have an agenda. I mean, really, it's...
Yeah, it's just constantly going on. Balance is diachronic, right? It's not a static state. It's like in the book, I liken it to walking. You walk like this or riding a bike. Balance is something you attain dynamically and diachronically over time, not at a static moment where you're just like this, okay, I'm balanced, right? That's very much very Platonic, very Western, this notion that the ideal state is a state of stasis, of peace, of harmony, right? Mm. Think of the forms for Plato, think of heavens for Christian. Yeah, I mean, Talking Heads, I think they say nothing ever happens in heaven. You know, it's just there.
Mm.
Well, this change is a sign of imperfection, right?
Well, the example of riding a bike is great because when you first start, I mean, it takes an excess of energy, but it still always is taking energy to keep it upright, even once you know.
Yeah,
you know, you never get away from the struggle.
Yeah, look at little kids learning how to walk. Mm. Ooh, I mean, and then elders when they lose the ability to walk.
All of life is a bell curve.
Yep, there you go.
Dear me. It's beautiful though. It's beautiful.
It is.
And I wish Westerners could just gel with that acceptance that comes with that a bit more. I mean, there is a further question there because from, once again, I have to apologize for always bringing in the Western viewpoint, but it's...
Yeah, that's where we're coming from.
Exactly. Try and make it a bit more accessible. But it seems that we might say that Aztec philosophy is intertwined with what we would then consider theology with so it seems from this worldview, it's very easy to actually like almost very easy to sort of begin to stand before, say, a river, like a fast flowing river, and engage in some form of reverence, which we might say it's close to worship. So it's almost like naturally some form of reverential relationship begins. But you don't need these explicit anthropomorphized things. It's just an acceptance.
It's awesome.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, the world is awesome, right? Look at storms, clouds, childbirth, riding a bike, that river, the ocean. It's awesome. And that which is sacred is awesome, right? It's... Mm.
And there isn't a moralizing of this awesomeness. So on the other hand of this, we, you know, it's something I think about a lot at the moment. We often push away the night, the dark, blood, you know, as Schopenhauer would say, the cries of the deer are worse than the happiness of the lion that killed it. But this seems to be completely balanced. You would see that and say, well, you know, that's the other side that has to happen. Night has to come and the sun has to set. So there was also a reverence of that side of things as well. There isn't a moralization of the two sides.
No. I mean, to make one good and one evil, would to fundamentally misunderstand this view. I mean, there are these, what they call enomic partners, these matched partners, male, female, hot, cold, wet, dry, above, below. There's a long list of them, and noticeably absent from that list from our perspective is there's no good evil. There's no Manichaean forces of light versus forces of darkness, God versus the devil. All of that is completely absent from this view. There are good people and good actions and bad people and bad actions, but there's no notion of goodness per se or evil per se. That's part of this, you know, some struggle between, like I say, God and the devil, or forces of light and forces of darkness. It's just not there. So all of that you just got to throw out because you just don't understand it. And I think that's the same with Taoism, right? Mm-hmm. Yin yang, you're just going, right? Yin isn't beautiful and good, and yang isn't evil. It's just the whole thing's just going, just chugs along. Mm-hmm. And you try to get in harmony. Oops, harmony. You try to get in balance with it. You try to get in sync with it. Yeah. And I mean, humans had, right, one noticeable difference too is that just sort of goes back to humans being born with original debt, but not sin, because we didn't do anything wrong. We're just born with this obligation. And for the Nahuas, I mean, you and I born from our parents were born obligated to take care of them when they're old, right? Very East Asian notion that Western people have now abandoned. But you're born obligated to them. They went through pain and suffering and hardship to give birth to you, especially your mother. And then your community, your family, all these people put energy into raising you. And now you're obligated to return that, to re-gift that, to reciprocate. One of the things essential to this is that humans have this responsibility to keep the world going. So that the world is, in a sense, open. I mean, the fifth age is open and it's participatory. Namely, humans contribute to the ongoing becoming and transforming and processing of the fifth age. We have to do that in order to keep it going. We are not sort of, you know, sort of ancillary to it. It's not going to keep going if we all die. It's not going to, we have to keep it going. That's part of our job.
So might the, might it be said from an Aztec philosophical point of view, the reason the modern world is so, you know, polluted, selfish, greedy, pig-headed, is because we have a single direction. You know, we're born and then we go, right, it's all about me, and we don't give back. We don't have any sense of obligation.
No, none whatsoever.
In fact, we're taught pretty much the opposite.
That's what individualism's about, right? I know people who, you know, people I knew growing up would say, look, I didn't choose to be born. I don't owe my parents anything. There was their choice. They wanted me. I don't owe them squat. Contemporary Nahuatl speakers, of which there are about 4 million in Mexico today, if you talk with them, they'll say, yeah, you guys are, you know, you guys have put the world out of balance. You know, you don't ever reciprocate. You just take. And the world's full of persons and you're abusing them and you're constantly taking from them without regifting, without restoring balance. So, yeah, that is how they would diagnose it.
But oddly, that seems to be to our detriment as well, even though we're fairly ignorant of it.
Yeah.
You know, we end up, we end up sort of purposeless and depressed and wondering why everything, you know, is so rubbish. Nothing fulfills.
Mentally diseased, disordered. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, no, there's this melding prudential / moral reason to reciprocate.
So one thing I want to bring in is sort of the Aztec animism. You know, the animist aspects of it's sort of been floating throughout all of this. I mean, in what sense could we understand this as an animism?
It's animism in the sense that everything is constituted by and ultimately one with Teot, this life energy, which vivifies, which energizes, which everything. There's of recent more and more sort of Western scholars have been returning to animism. Early on, you know, 100 years ago, 120 years ago, early anthropologists like Tyler described these views as animist and then quickly said, well, it's just very infantile, right? Only children think that, you know, balls or, you know, bamboo are animate. So there was a reaction, I think, in the anthropological community they said, yeah, right, that is. So what they did was turn to symbolic anthropology and they turned all Aztec activities, rituals into symbolic activities. So now everybody's walking around in this world of symbols. It's just sort of this Disneyland of symbols. All actions are symbolic. Nothing is, in a sense, what it is. It's all symbolic of something else. I think this also has its roots in Protestantism, but I won't go there right now.
You can go there.
Well, it has to do with, you know, reinterpreting the Eucharist as symbolic rather than the Catholic saying that you're really eating Jesus' flesh and drinking his blood. So people are returning this. So, yeah, everything's alive. Statues, artworks, like I say, plants, animals, rivers, mountains, they're persons. So,
and when you think like that, it's much more difficult to disrespect them.
It is. There are actually some really nice stories, both in on contemporary Nahuatl speakers, and you also find them historically in the Andes. There's a famous pot with a depiction on the side of it called the Revolt of the Utensils by us. But this happens in with the Nahuatl speakers as well, that human beings, at some point, human beings are like abusing their cooking pots and their spoon, their bows and arrows, their matates, their grinding stones and everything. And at some point, the utensils revolt and they rise up and they beat the hell out of the human beings. Like the cooking pots and the spoons and stuff are like whacking them and everything. It is easy to abuse things when you think it's just lifeless, dead stuff. Right? I mean, that's why we abuse nature, right? Just stuff. Oh, there's very easy to abuse it if it's not a person.
Absolutely. I mean, it makes me think of the philosopher Michel Serre, who writes about the idea that we need a natural contract with nature. We have a natural contract with nature.
Yeah.
If you do rock climbing, it isn't all your reason. The rock has its place in the sense. I mean, he's writing. And then in relation, he writes about pollution in the sense of it's like passing around a salad bowl and then one person goes, oh, okay, and spits in it and then tries to pass it on, right? So we keep doing that. But if you don't think the thing is inanimate, it's just this material, then all of a sudden, yeah, you're not going to want to litter. You're going to respect the rock that you're hammering. I don't know, whatever it might be into.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, as beautiful and as strangely simple as Aztec philosophy is, I mean, just to sort of be abstract, there is a certain sense of, you know, you mentioned earlier awe, but there's a certain sense of like sort of not dread, not fear, but like something close to horror, but that doesn't have the negative connotations. I guess it is just like awestruck.
Well, I mean, we are all struck by it, but there is this notion that it's a very fragile balance and you got to keep working at it. And there's an adage that's been reproduced called that was collected and reproduced by one of the early Spaniards, a guy named Bernardino de Sahagún, called, and it goes, "The earth is slippery." And supposedly this was something you do say after someone who had been living a well-balanced, morally upright life committed a wrongdoing, slipped into adultery, slipped into thievery or greed. And the earth is slippery, right? Namely, life, this balance we have is very slippery. Yeah. You like that and you're on your rear, right? In the muck. For them, they sort of envisioned another metaphor is that we live between two mountain peaks on this very narrow, harpoon sharp like path. So we're balancing, we're going down this thing, and it's really easy to lose your balance. And either side of the abyss, I mean, either side of the path, there's an abyss, which is disorder, imbalance, dis-ease. So, yeah, there's this notion that it's all very fragile. It's awesome, but it all could collapse at any moment if we don't, I mean, keep up, if we don't maintain our vigil. And so some people sort of characterize this sort of this Aztec pessimism. I don't think it's pessimistic. They just know things are fragile. Mm. Yeah.
Things end.
Yeah. And they end all too easily, right? I mean, you know, you and I can get hit by a car the 5 minutes after we end this.
Yeah.
Right.
But then, that would be pessimistic if there was a hard stop. But you would, I guess, maybe for Aztec philosophy, you'd say, I get hit by a car, I get put in the ground, and then my body feeds a tree, or what, right?
Process. No, there are these energies recirculate. I mean, it can be a little bit more frightening if you think that, I mean, the fifth age will come to an end, mm-hmm. this fifth creation, this fifth engendering. But after that, the Aztecs don't really know what's going to happen, but it's hard not to imagine that Teotl will just keep chugging along, right? And the world as we know it will have collapsed, but this energy, Teotl, will just keep on going. What will happen next, we can't say. But so it's just life as we know it will come to an end, but not a hard stop, because all destructions, all endings are beginnings, and all beginnings are endings, right?
Yeah. So how is it, you know, you moved from very sterile analytic philosophy. How has it influenced your own life?
It helps me see the world in just precisely this way.
Has it brought you more peace? Even though that's a very Western word. More balance?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm not sure I fully embrace animism when it comes to, you know, sidewalks. It's hard for me to do that. But I mean, it's, yeah, it, the more you get into it, in order to understand it, you know, the more, you know, I find it convincing and embracing.
So where do you see Aztec philosophy's influence possibly bleeding through into other philosophies, or probably places it's been a bit mutated?
Well, I mean, a lot of the main tenets that we've been talking about are shared throughout what scholars call Mesoamerica, Maya philosophy, you know, Zapotec, Mixtec, Huicho, Cora. This philosophy continues to influence contemporary native peoples of Mexico. I mean, it also has strong resonances with indigenous Andean philosophies, this notion of complementarity and processing and becoming. I think it also has lots of resonances with indigenous North American philosophies as well. And, right, and at least Taoism, some East Asian is. Do I think this is going to change Western academic philosophy? I doubt it. I don't know the answer to that question.
We love our reasons too much.
Well, yeah, at least a particular way of reasoning, yeah.
So what are you working on now? So are you working on a full book on Aztec morality, or is that?
Well, I started doing that, and then I sort of got waylaid a little bit by a book on, there are these, let's see, where can I, there are these books that are Aztec, that are called, the Western people call them codices. Mm-hmm. The Aztecs had supposedly libraries with hundreds of these books, and they were promptly burned by the Spaniards, of course, Taliban style. And I think maybe 6-8 survived. Some were repainted shortly after the conquest, and people think they're faithful. But they have images like this. Mm-hmm. This is actually a Cosmo topogram. It's a rendering. It's actually, I think it's a fractalization of the structure of space and time. Mm-hmm. This is from a Codex Feherberry-Mayer. You can find all of these reproduced free of charge in beautiful color on a website called FAMSI. Go to a place called Codices, I think, and you'll find them. I'm looking at some of these that were devoted to what we would think of as sort of astrological divination. But I'm arguing that the images on these, the native reports shortly post-conquest describe these figures as something called an eshipla. And that is basically a god presencing. You can make a god presence in a statue. A human being can make present, right, become a particular god. And these paint and ink images are also these god presences. So I'm arguing that rather than reading these things function as presencing these gods, and they put you into contact with them so that you can talk with them. Mm-hmm. So that there's the primary means of communication with these powerful other than humans is oral, conversational. It's oracular rather than reading. There's a book print bias going on in most scholarship, and I'm trying to correct that by arguing that these folks are all about speaking, conversing with the gods, not reading their books. The gods don't send us missives, postcards. They don't write on the wall. They don't send us a Bible. They tell us how to make them present, and then we interact with them in this localized way.
Wow. So you're writing a, is that a paper on that or a whole?
It's a book. Yeah.
It's a book.
Way too long. So, yeah. But in the process, it's sort of trying to re-center orality. Because like I say, I think people are too vision oriented. They turn everything into reading, into looking, into seeing, when I don't think Nahuatl was not a written language. So I think it's an oral culture, and in oral cultures, you communicate and transmit knowledge and information orally. You don't do it by writing a book.
Is there anything you'd like to add about Aztec philosophy that you feel is key, or you don't often get a chance to add in?
I don't know what more to say. Okay. I mean, you can ask more. I always have more to say, but it's hard just to know what to just volunteer.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Oh, I can send you or your listeners links to articles on Aztec ethics. I've written a couple on them, and it has to do with this notion of reciprocity, of meriting, of gifting and regifting, of creating social relationships. Balanced social relationship is modeled upon this notion of weaving back and forth. You talk, I talk. In a conversation, we weave ourselves together into a relationship through this mutual exchange of life energy, of chikahuilitzli. And that's the model for weaving ourselves socially into a well-woven social fabric, weaving ourselves into the cosmos, into a well-woven, human and other than human social fabric. It's all, weaving is very, very powerful here. And it's very cool because most of us, having seen too many History Channel, or Mel Gibson movies, think of the Aztecs as these bloody people, and that death and sacrifice and blood and war is at the core here. But the fundamental metaphor at the basis of their metaphysics is a female gendered activity, and that's weaving back and forth, weft going back this way, that in this ordering, transforming, the disorder of, I have a piece of, I can't find it. You find rough, when you get an aspirin bottle at the pharmacy, you pull out a plug of cotton. Mm-hmm. And somehow this is this amazing transformation that takes place between that disordered rough cotton into this shirt, right? This well-ordered shirt where warp and weft are balanced, but they're always struggling against one another. And that's how the cosmos is generated, and by the gods, but it's also how we generate good, right, well-ordered, well-balanced social interpersonal relationships. So that, I think, is worth emphasizing.
Well, I'll be sure to put, if you send me the links for those papers ethics, I'll put them in the description below, and I'll also put the link for your book in the description below, which can be found, I imagine, all good bookstores, and also the University Press of Colorado.
Yeah, and e-copies at a relatively low cost. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Well, Jim Maffey, I think it's been a great conversation. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.